a few at a time before and during supper. Don't poke along, but don't rush. What of Varen and the men on guard duty? Shouldn't they be told? Someone asked. They'll all be at the gates. Let them stay there in case this is only part of the attack, Vesgar replied. We'll keep this just among us for now. Ali nodded approval to Lokage, who winked. The Rakkar leaders had trained their people well. The old man followed her outside. Too bad you don't have this organization in Rajmuat, she whispered to Lokage. The old man raised his thin, hard brows. But we shall, he replied, his voice quiet. We guarded our ladies, the girls and Sarugani, in that sinkhole for longer than you've been alive, Kiprioth's mouse. The bigger part of us went to other houses when we were exiled. Our folk recruit more people in the city even now. They know we will come again, and they mean us to have help when we do. Ali smiled. I don't know why the guard bothered with me, she told Lokage. Because you have the crooked eye and the memory, and you can talk to the Luaren, Lokage said promptly. We see 4 or 5 paths where you see 20. Will you go with our family tonight? Ali nodded. I won't be of any use in a fight among all those warriors, she replied. But I'd like to have at least one assassin alive at the end, if you can manage. Lokage nodded. One day you have to tell us who you were before slavery. Why it is you are so knowing, so young. Ali shrugged. I'm the god's chosen, she reminded him. True, Lokage replied. But the gods never built without a foundation. A crooked eye like yours takes years of work. He glanced at Ali's clothes. What are you? I'd clean up. You pour the wine tonight. Ali looked down at herself. Her tunic was streaked with horse sweat. She grimaced and ran to find her spare clothes. At supper, Ali watched everyone from her position on the dais. She couldn't tell whether the Rakkar members of the household were excited or nervous. Their faces, ranging in color from dark ivory to coppery brown, looked just as stoic as they always had. Centuries of Luaren rule had taught the native islanders iron control. The prince's servants and the rest of the household behaved normally, chattering and eating heartily. In the shadows by the main stair, Ali glimpsed movement, but only because she looked for it. A few Rakkar used that route to the upper stories. Most relied on the servant's stair behind the stone veil of the wall. By the end of the meal, every Rakkar fighter who did not eat with the family was in position. Ali saw no reason to alarm the Balitongs until they'd finished supper. They were halfway through the dessert sweets and cheeses when Ali murmured to the Duke and Duchess, We must place you in the study opposite your present quarters for your safety. If you can gather the children and the prince and go there, acting as if you were engaged in some leisure activity, I would appreciate it. No one must think there's anything out of the ordinary. The Duke gave the tiniest of nods while the Duchess looked down. As Ali returned the wine to the kitchen, she heard the Duchess say gaily, I have a game we haven't played yet. My dears, your highness, it's one that you won't have played in quite this fashion. I love that woman, Ali thought as she set down the pitcher. She is never at a loss. Jenna'ol joined Ali. My girls know their places. Ulasim has men on the exits. Come down here once the fighting's done and I'll have your supper ready. Ali grinned at her. You have a nice idea of what's important, she told the cook. Try not to kill any more of them than necessary. They have to be questioned. Chenaol drew the cleaver from her waistband as Ali walked back into the great hall. The kitchen servants were on their way to Chenaol as the tables emptied. No one was interested in music that night. Ali suspected that everyone felt tension in the air, even if they didn't know the reason for it. Ali climbed the stairs, searching the shadows for shapes that didn't belong. By now she could have found her way through any part of the keep in pitch darkness. Tonight she saw nothing unusual. She hadn't expected to. The enemy might use the servant stair or the 5th-floor storeroom as a hiding place from which to launch their attack, but that meant the risk of someone from the household tripping over them before it was time to strike. Ali expected the attack to come from the roof. She would use that route in the assassin's place. How many people looked up? If her instinct was right, They'd be there now, waiting for lights to go out below, knowing the shutters would be left open for cool night air to flow through the keep. Once the household seemed to be abed, the assassins would use ropes to climb down the tower's sides and swing into their prey's bedrooms. Ali reached the third-floor landing and the family's present bedrooms. By now, the enemy would know that the prince had the ducal rooms and the Balitongs occupied the third floor. Since they were obviously professionals, Ali knew they would know their target's sleeping arrangements well before their attack. Ulasim stood by the stairway, a long dagger in each hand. No one wanted to speak more than necessary in case the assassins were already inside the keep. Ulasim pointed to the floor, jerked a thumb at the ceiling, and nodded. Everything was ready on the second and fourth floors. Fezgal lounged in the shadows near the door to the family's sleeping quarters. He nodded too. Fighters were hidden inside. Ali pointed to the door of the small room by the stair that served as the children's tiny schoolroom and raised her brows. Ulasim nodded. The family and the prince were there. Carefully, Ali opened the door just enough to slip inside. "Why is she here?" demanded Bronow, keeping his voice soft.
"She is as useful in a fight as I am, Your Highness," Lokage retorted. "We want her out of harm's way."
He clutched a double-headed axe in his gnarled hands. Ali expected the old Rakha to fall over with its weight, but he stood easily, balanced on the balls of his feet. Behind him stood the healer Rihani, her arms around Elsrin and Patran. They stared silently at everyone. Elsrin sucked his thumb. Lokage was not the only armed man in the room. Both the Duke and the Prince held drawn swords.
"I don't like hiding like this," growled Bronow. "I'd rather fight them myself."
"And leave my wife and children protected only by Lokage?" asked Mequen.
"It's not as satisfying as engaging the enemy in the field, old friend, but it's important to me."
"I could defend myself if I had a sword,"
Sarai reminded the adults, her voice sharp. Bronow smiled at her.
"I would love to see you with a sword in hand," he said. It was clear he thought she would make an adorable picture rather than a combat-ready one. "With a gold hilt and gold armor to match, you could be one of the lady knights of old at the midwinter masquerade."
"And you haven't had a sword in your hand in 4 years," murmured Dove. "Whose fault is that?"
snapped the older girl, darting a sharp glance at her stepmother. Ali crouched by the keyhole in the door. Outside, she heard the first signs of trouble.
"Hush,"
she ordered as she put her ear to the opening.
"Mequen, you are indulgent of your slaves, but surely you won't let this one give orders as if she were one of us?"
exclaimed Bronow, outraged. The Duchess held her finger to her lips to silence him. Ali put an eye to the keyhole, mentally adjusted her power, and exercised her sight to see as much of the story as she could. Fezgal was gone from his post at the bedroom door. Thumps came from the family's bedroom, and a cry from overhead. She tried to see the stairs, but the keyhole limited her field of vision to the joining of step and floor, something her sight could not change. Just once she wished she could scry in a mirror or crystal like her mother and Uncle Lumiere so she could know what was going on. From the stairwell, Ali heard a scream. Behind her, someone gasped. Patran or Elsrin. Ulasim came into view at the foot of the stair, a killer's descending sword trapped between his long crossed knives. He twisted away to free his weapons. As the assassin's sword dropped, Ulasim lunged in with a backhanded dagger swipe. Ali saw blood, enough to tell her that Ulasim had cut the assassin's throat. The assassin tumbled limply down the stairs past the Rakha footmen. Ulasim checked to make sure his opponent was dead, then ran upstairs once more. The fighting seemed to last forever, though Ali knew that it was her own worry and impatience that stretched the passing time. She sent up prayers to Mithros for the Balitong servants, along with frequent reminders to Kiprioth that if she was to do as he wished, he would have to keep the people who worked with her alive. Finally, the noise from the upper floors and across the hall faded. There was a long silence. Then Fezgal emerged from the family's bedchamber, his clothes slashed in two places, a bloody longsword weighing down his left arm. Behind him came the Rakha who had been hidden in the bedroom. Ulasim walked onto the floor from the direction of the stairs, his long, sweat-soaked hair hanging in his face. Three more Balitong fighters moved into view,
carrying bodies wrapped in sheets over their shoulders. They laid them on the floor.
Ulasim said huskily, "We think we have them all."
Ali let the prince and the duke out first, then the duchess and Sarai. She glanced at Lokage, then nodded toward Dove, Rahani, Patran, and Elzrin. He nodded in reply, indicating he would guard them until they were certain the keep had been scoured of the enemy.
"Until we're sure," Ali told Dove.
The girl sighed and took a seat. Rahani's smile was bright with gratitude. Ali closed the door on her way out, ignoring Patran's cry of indignation.
"They came in on ropes, through the windows, Highness, your graces,"
Ulasim was telling the nobles.
"They were on the roof as we guessed they might be."
"Why didn't you take them on the roof?"
demanded Bronow as he and the duke sheathed their swords.
"You would have spared us some anxiety."
"We have but one door to the roof. Only one may go through at a time, your highness,"
Fezgal said with a properly respectful bow.
"They could have picked us off as they liked, and we could not be certain all of them were there. As it happens, they were not. My lads report there are still others outside."
He looked at the duke and the duchess.
"You appear to have been their targets. Perhaps the children, too, since they sleep here as well."
There was a clatter on the stair. Veron, with the men-at-arms who had been on guard duty, charged up, swords bared. Ulasim and Fezgal put themselves between the nobles and the men-at-arms.
"Your grace, I heard fighting,"
the sergeant panted, ignoring the two rakah between him and his master.
Mequin raised a hand, palm out, a calming gesture.
"Our servants defended us, Veron. Apparently assassins were smuggled into the keep during the day. Or rather, they smuggled themselves."
"I feared it was bandits," the sergeant replied.
He looked around at the bodies, then knelt and uncovered a face.
"I'll have a word with my boys, letting these get through the inner gate," he promised.
He looked up at the duke.
"With your permission, I'd like to search the keep top to bottom."
"Tell me something first," asked Ulasim, his face stern.
"Tell me you did not know of this attempt."
Veron's jaw muscles clenched, then relaxed. When he replied, he spoke to Mequen.
"No, your grace," he replied quietly. "I did not know of it."
Ulasim glanced at Ali, who gave the tiniest of nods. Veron was telling the truth. Her sight confirmed it, though she would tell the others that he showed none of the signs of a liar.
"What is this?" Mequen demanded, his voice sharp. "Why should Veron know assassins had come? You make it sound as if he would have helped them."
Ulasim and Fezgal regarded Veron with unflinching eyes. The sergeant flushed beet red, hesitated, then knelt, his eyes on the duke.
"Your grace, forgive me," he said, shamefaced. "Somehow these men have learned I'm ordered to report your actions to the crown. I am your grace's servant, but the king is also my master."
After a moment, Veron added,
"Surely your grace understood that watchers would be present in your household."
"Kill the traitorous dog,"
Bronow snapped, grey eyes flashing.
"A man should have but one master. You pay him, he should be yours alone."
Winamine rested a gentle hand on her husband's arm.
"We should not decide this now, when so much of pressing importance must be attended to right away," she murmured.
Mequin lifted her hand to his lips and kissed her fingertips before he released her.
"Wise as ever, my dear," he said.
Ali nodded to Ulasim and Fezgal. They moved aside so Veron could see the duke better. Mequin told him,
"Very well. Do as thorough a search as you and your men can perform."
"I trust you didn't take all of your guards off the gate,"
Prince Bronow said with a smile.
Veron stiffened.
"Really," Ali thought. "For a prince, he's got no tact. The duke trusts Veron to do his job properly, royal spy or no. Bronow could at least have trusted the duke's judgment." As Veron led his men back down the stairs, Ali realized that the prince would make a dreadful husband for Sarai. Bronow would encourage Sarai to be even more headstrong than she already was if she didn't kill him for condescending to her desire to be a warrior. The nobles walked into the family's bedroom. Fezgal and Ulasim accompanied them. Ali took a moment to memorize the faces of the three dead men, assassins often came in families, before she went inside. There she sighed. The wide, pretty chamber was a shambles. Multicolored raka hangings, embroidered cushions, tapestry frames, pillows, comforters, bolsters, and curtains from the main bed all were hacked and covered in goose feathers speckled with blood. Four assassins lay sprawled on the floor, weapons still in their hands. The fifth knelt beside the door between two impassive raka. His arms, wrists, and ankles were bound, his mouth tightly gagged. Blood streamed down his face from a cut in his scalp. He was the man Ali had identified as the leader. His green eyes were stony as they met hers. She looked at the other bodies. Here were two of the merchant's regular employees, as well as two more strangers. The count of dead outside included two of those she had recognized as assassins, as well as one of the merchant's people. Where was that red-headed woman? Was it possible that she wasn't an assassin, but a spy, trying to root out secrets in the village at that very moment? Sarai bent and picked up one killer's sword, easily taking its weight in her delicate hand. She held it upright. "No maker's mark on the hilt," she commented to herself. "But if this isn't royal foundry work, I don't know swords." Bronow chuckled.
"Sarai, you startle me. How would you learn that?"
Sarai lowered the blade slowly. Ali was impressed. She knew swords were heavier than they looked. It took control and strength in the wrist and arm to do what Sarai was doing. The Duke wandered over to the bed. He was idly brushing at feathers, looking around, when a heap of curtains a yard away shifted. Up came the missing woman, her teeth bared in fury, a long knife clutched in her hand. Ali felt as if she were struggling through honey, she was so slow. Like Ali, Ulasim, Fezgau, and the prince all stood on the wrong side of the bed, closer to the door than Mequen. The Duchess gasped. Mequen scrabbled at his sword hilt. But Sarai, the killer's weapon still in her hand, lunged across the gap. Her arm stretched out in a long, ferocious thrust that pierced the woman through. Swiftly, she braced a foot against the assassin's body and freed her sword, then cut the woman's throat, just to be sure. The 16-year-old looked around at the rest of them, brown eyes wide, blood on her hands, face, and clothes. "It's so messy," she murmured in surprise. Then she fainted. Ali, trembling, went to her and knelt. Using her sight, she confirmed the girl hadn't been wounded or poisoned. "Though it would serve me right if she had been," Ali thought, furious with herself. "Idiot! I shouldn't have let anyone come back in here until I checked the room. That's my job, and I was too overconfident to do it." Feathers and cloth rustled as Winamine joined her. She had found a pitcher of water and handkerchiefs. She wet a handkerchief, wrung it out, and began to clean her stepdaughter's face. Ali soaked and wrung out other handkerchiefs and began to wipe Sarai's hands as the girl began to come around. When Sarai opened her eyes, Winamine gave her a tiny smile. Her mouth trembled. "Obviously halting your sword lessons was a mistake," she murmured to Sarai. "It's a crime not to encourage such an aptitude." Sarai stared at her stepmother. "But I fainted," she whispered. "After," said Winamine. "You did it after you'd done the important thing." She bit her lip, then continued, "We shall find you a teacher in the morning. In fact, though it may be too late, I may study swordcraft too. And Dove?" Sarai gulped, tried to speak, and could not. At last she cleared her throat and said, "She hates swords. She does like to shoot, if she doesn't have to shoot animals." "Archery it is," Winamine said. She blinked overbright eyes, then leaned in and kissed Sarai's cheek. "Thank you for saving his life." She took a deep breath, then rose and went to see how her husband was. Sarai looked at Ali. "If I'd known that all it would take to start my lessons again was killing someone." Her voice and humor failed. Her eyes overflowed. "Did I do the right thing?" she whispered. Ali cleaned blood from Sarai's other hand as the other girl wept silently. "You did better than me," she replied softly. "I just stood and stared. But I wasn't needed. Sarai, balance a murderess's life against your father's. This entire household would prefer the Duke to an assassin." "There's one who disagrees," Sarai remarked as she struggled to sit up. She pointed to the last living killer. He'd made no sound as the drama had unfolded. Now he stared blankly into the air. Ali sighed. "Will you be all right?" she asked Sarai. A hand reached down, the Duke's. Sarai took it and let her father pull her up into his arms. Ali stood and went to Fezgau and Ulasim. Bronau had gone out to the landing where he inspected the dead men. "Perhaps he should be reminded that his servants are missing," Ali murmured to Ulasim, "and that if he wishes to see their welfare, he should go to the barracks. I don't want him noticing me any more than he already has." At a look from Ulasim, Fezgau went out into the hall. He bowed politely to the prince and spoke to him as Ulasim and Ali watched.
"She was beautiful, our Sarayu, wasn't she?" Ulasim inquired, his mouth barely moving as he whispered. "Like Gunapi, the sun rose, goddess of war and molten rock."
"She was," Ali admitted. Her eyes stung strangely. The last time she had seen so perfect a fighting move was when her mother had battled pirates at the swoop.
"Without you, all might have been lost," Ulasim told Ali suddenly.
He picked up one of her hands and pressed it to his forehead.
"We owe our lives to you, and our thanks to the god for you tonight."
Ali yanked her hand from his grip, unnerved by his intensity.
"Ulasim, calm down," she said, forcing amusement into her voice. "I just alerted you about some assassins, that's all."
He surveyed her from his greater height. Ali had expected him to be offended by her light brush-off. Instead, he smiled.
"I always forget you are not of us. We think you are Ra'ka in your heart, but no, you are newly come. No one teaches a slave the laws that govern the Isles. Had this Sissat," he pointed to the still-living assassin with his dagger, "killed even one Balitang or the prince, then every Ra'ka man, woman, and child of Tener village and castle would die. That is the Luaran law governing such things."
"Oh, but these are Luaran assassins, and I'd bet whatever I own that they were sent by the king," Ali pointed out. "If he sent them, surely he wouldn't enforce that law."
Her voice trailed off as she registered the grimness on Ulasim's face.
"Even if he sent the assassins himself?" she asked, wanting badly for it not to be true and fearing that it was.
"The idea is that if any member of the Luaran nobility is killed, the nearest local Ra'ka must have helped the murderer. At the very least, the courts would say that the local Ra'ka did not die to stop the killers," added the Duke.
He stood behind them, one arm around Winamin, one around Sarai. Both he and Sarai looked mournful.
"It's insane. But Oran is quite mad. The law itself comes from the time of the Luaran conquest. It's how they broke the spine of the Ra'ka rebellion. Some of us have laid petitions before the courts to have the conqueror's laws repealed, to no avail."
He shook his head. Ali stared.
"That is just not right," she thought. "To murder people who had nothing to say about it just because they were near?"
She understood why there were such laws. They were made to fit a conqueror's logic, used to keep a captive people under control. She had just never matched the law to the faces of people she knew, like the Balitang Ra'ka. "I don't want to get involved with this country," she thought as she looked at the floor. "I must go home soon, before I get so wound up in their lives and injustices that I'll never want to leave." The prince trotted down the stairs, two of Fezgau's weary men following. Fezgau himself walked back into the bedroom.
"Ali, what do you recommend for this man?" he asked, nodding to their prisoner. "Torture?"
Startled at the suggestion, she met his eyes and realized that this was yet another test. She made a face at him. "Any amateur knows torture is chancy at best. People do still lie under torture. What you need is truth drops." Fezgau gave a tiny smile and went to find Rehani. Ali looked at Ulasim.
"So I may look forward to these little exercises until I die, is that it?" she asked brightly. "Or will you decide I'm not some Luaran brute before I am, say, 50?
Ulasim wiped one of his long daggers on a cloth.
"Oh, more like 40, I'm sure," he replied casually.
He flipped the dagger up casually, caught it by the hilt, and in the next motion cut the gag from the last assassin's mouth.
Who sent you? He asked.
The man stared at the Rakha, expressionless.
Once we have truth drops in hand, you will speak, Ulasim pointed out. Keep your pride and tell us now. Don't wait for magic to force you.
The man leaned forward and spat on the floor. Fezga returned from the room across the hall with Rehani in tow. She held a small, uncorked vial in her hand. Ali was startled by the healer's steely gaze. Normally, Rehani was as fierce as pudding.
Open his mouth, Rehani ordered.
A band of green fire locked around the assassin's throat and tightened, vanishing into his flesh. The man choked. Green fire coated his mouth in Ali's sight as his face got redder and redder. The veins bulged in his throat and forehead as he fought for air. Within a moment, he was dead. Ali bit her tongue to keep from shouting her frustration at the lost opportunity. This is why we need a mage who is not just a healer, she said quietly, looking into Ulasim's face. And I should have seen that coming. She turned and ran down the servant's stair before she gave in to the temptation to shout. It was time to get some cool air.
Sloppy, she thought as she strode outside. Sloppy not to check the room for assassins before I so much as let a Balitong set foot outside that protected room. Sloppy not to think he might have a silencing spell on him before we set it in motion. What else have I missed? There are ways to stop a silencing spell, and Sarai shouldn't have had to kill anyone.
I have to be sharper, she told herself, gently thumping her head on the keep's stone wall as a reminder. I won't get lucky a second time. The inner and outer courtyards crawled with Bronau's and Mequen's men-at-arms. They were looking for anyone suspicious, turning the buildings upside down in their search. Three guards from the merchant's caravan lay dead at the entrance to the kitchen wing. Bronau's and the Balitong soldiers searched the bodies. Laid out in front of the barracks, awaiting proper burial, were two of the castle's own, one of the former bandits and one of the official men-at-arms. Ali murmured a prayer to the Black God for their rest in the realms of the dead, then wandered back toward the keep. She heard voices behind the kitchen wing, where a tiny garden had been built for Tener's ladies. A small door opened directly to the servants' halls inside the tower. Its torches cast light onto two dead merchant's guards lying on the path that led into the carefully landscaped garden. Two of Ulasim's servants stood beside them, but their attention was on the fig tree that shaded the walk. Intrigued, Ali walked over to see what was going on. The two dead men were the first that night who had not been killed by blades. Both lay face down, with dents between their shoulders and their heads twisted askew.
"Please come down," a Balitong hostler was saying to the tree. "You have already unnerved us enough for one night, Duan."
The title meant Honorable Sir, used to a man who was not a noble.
"Ulasim will wish to know what you did here."
Ali looked up. Nawat, perched easily on a branch that should not have held his weight, gazed down at her. With his dark, long-nosed face surrounded by leaves and growing figs, he looked like some wilderness god.
"Now what are you up to?" Ali demanded as her conscience pinched her. She should have told Nawat what was going to happen tonight so that he could have decided whether or not he wanted to be caught up in human quarrels.
"I am up to nothing," the crow man said cheerfully. "Those two were going to mob you through that door." He pointed to the door into the keep. "I stopped them." Ali knelt beside the dead men. Their necks were broken. The dents in their backs looked like the prints of bare feet. She glanced at his. They were bare.
"How did you do it?" she asked her strange friend.
"I saw it," said another servant, one of the footmen. "We had the duty here. They was coming at us, and all of a sudden he leaps up in the dark and hits one in the back with both feet, kicking out like. Then he did it to the other, and then he jumped into the tree."
Ali stared up at Nawat. "He must be very strong to break bone with jumping kicks from a standing position," she thought. "Well, crows are very strong."
"You could have been hurt," she told him. "They might have killed you."
The hostler snorted.
"Not him."
Nawat's gaze was steady as he looked down at Ali. "They were going to mob you," he repeated firmly. "I mobbed them. Only I added a hawk thing. When the hawk strikes, he breaks the head of the prey. I did that." Ali rubbed her temples.
"Thank you,"
she said. "Will you come down now? I think we have them all." Nawat smiled brightly at her.
"I will come down for you, Ali."
He jumped down as lightly as a cat. Ali patted his cheek absently and let him come along as they patrolled the rest of the castle grounds. It was hours before the castle's residents calmed enough to go to bed. Ali was in the kitchen, finishing a very late supper, when the Duchess's maid, Pemberi, found her.
"His Grace wishes to see you in the ground floor study," she told Ali and yawned.
"Don't take forever. I can't go to bed until the family is settled."
Ali sighed. She would have liked to go to bed herself. Instead, she found the Duke in the small room where she had cleaned up the day Bronow had arrived. There was a bottle and a glass on a table by the Duke's hand, but the contents of the glass were untouched. The Duke himself was staring at a branch of candles, drumming his fingers on the arm of his chair. Ali bowed.
"Your Grace wished to see me?" she asked.
"Veron says the merchant Gurhart tells us that all of his people who became particular friends of the five newcomers are also among the dead," Mequin replied. "A search of their belongings has revealed gold Ceratudus and a death order under the crown seal."
"I'm sorry to hear that, Your Grace," Ali told him softly.
Mequin nodded.
"Gurhart swears by his own blood there are no other assassins among his people," Mequin continued, his dark eyes weary as he gazed at Ali. "He says he knew nothing of the assassin's true purpose in taking work with his caravan. Some of his people had vanished, so he was forced to hire these. I think we must assume those who disappeared while they were in Dimari were killed by the assassins, so that Gurhart would be forced to take them on."
Ali nodded. It was what she had expected they would hear. Hauling goods out to the back of beyond was not a trip anyone enjoyed. The road was hard, and its dangers were greater than the coastal routes. Gurhart would have leaped at the chance to replace his missing people, and assumed the vanished workers had simply decided not to go to Tenere. The Duke's voice, husky with exhaustion, hardened.
"What I find interesting, God's messenger, is that you did not warn us that danger was on the way. Instead, as far as my wife or I could learn from Ulasim or Fezgau, you observed the newcomers with the caravan and viewed them as a danger. It argues, you see, that the god has placed you here not as his oracle, but as his warrior."
"Oh no, Your Grace," Ali said, gleaming with innocence. "I'd break a nail on one of those dreadful swords. I just have a memory for faces. Maybe I saw one of the assassins back in Rajmuat. Well, he'd no right to be with a Lomban caravan, had he? Unless he was up to no good, of course. I said as much to Locage, who thought it worth passing along."
"And that is another thing," said the Duke. "How is it that I find my chief defenders here in the keep are servants and off-duty men-at-arms, not Veron and the men on watch? It was perfectly obvious that Ulasim and Fezgau were in command here, and that they consulted you. I will have the truth now, if you please."
Behind her mask of wide-eyed harmlessness, Ali cursed. She had walked head-on into his next hard question. She thought fast.
"I only noticed something odd, as I said," she lied. "And I wasn't sure of Veron being a royal spy and all. He was carefully watched, I assure you. We made certain he sent no reports to the crown after he reached Tenere. As for using the servants, it stands to reason that anyone Veron picks for regular night duty is probably someone loyal to him alone, willing to admit crown servants with orders against Your Grace."
"That those men are mostly the pure Luaran men-at-arms is not a factor?" Mequin wanted to know.
Ali sighed to herself. Why couldn't this man have been stupid? Instead, she replied, "Your Grace would have to inquire of Ulasim and Fezgau. Perhaps the ones with Raka blood look up to Your Grace for marrying a Raka the first time around."
"And producing half-Raka daughters in the Ritivan royal line?" asked the Duke very quietly.
Ali looked down and twiddled her thumbs. He was in possession of far too much of the whole picture for her comfort. "Your Grace's servants are devoted," she said. Mequin scowled.
"Are you incapable of giving a straight answer?" he demanded.
Ali grinned at him. "Not always, Your Grace," she replied impishly. Mequin drummed his fingers on his leg.
"We would be dead tonight, were it not for you people of our household," he said at last. "Be sure I will not forget it." His gaze hardened.
Any of it, Ali.
She scratched her head. You know, Your Grace, this will go so much easier for everyone if you accept the gods' gifts without question, she reminded him. Take it from me. You'll just give yourself headaches this way.
Mequen smiled. So I will. I suppose inquiring into your origins comes under the heading of questioning the gods' gifts.
Ali bowed her head meekly.
Oh, undoubtedly, Your Grace.
Very well. You are dismissed. With my thanks.
Ali was about to open the door when she thought of something else. She faced the Duke.
Your Grace also owes thanks to Lady Sarayu, she said, not sure if she was overstepping her bounds.
She will have her sword lessons again, if that is what concerns you, replied Mequen. After tonight, I think your Tortallan King is wiser than we are to allow women to take up arms. Sleep well.
A noble maiden must convey dignity and chastity without appearing to think about either one. Let common-born girls tussle in the hay with their loutish swains. The future of your family's bloodline and your future lord's bloodline should be your greatest concern. Let no man but one of your family embrace you. Let no man but your betrothed kiss any more than your fingertips. Let your betrothed kiss you only on fingers, cheek, or forehead, lest he think you unchaste. And never allow yourself to be alone with a man, to safeguard the precious jewel of your reputation. No well-born maiden ever suffered from keeping her suitors at arm's length. Your chastity will make you a prize to your future husband's house and an honor to your own. From Advice to Young Noble Women by Lady Fronia of Whitehall in Maran. Given to Ali on her 12th birthday by her godsmother, Queen Thayet.
Chapter 11. Migrations. To be on the safe side, Ali suggested to Ulasim that he might want to question Gerhardt, to see if he told the head footman the same story he had given to the Duke. She looked on as Ulasim and Fezgau interrogated the man using truth drops. Gerhardt's answers were the same as those he'd given Mequen. It was just a safety measure, but Ali was determined not to be overconfident again. She had been virtually sure of Gerhardt's innocence. He was too terrified to lie, and he should have been. Anyone but Mequen would have confiscated all Gerhardt owned and demanded lives as well. Here in the Isles, the Duke didn't even need to have the executions approved by a royal court, as he would in Tortall. On his own lands in the Isles, the Luaran noble had the rights of a king. Bronau would have demanded everything, but with Sarai to plead with him for clemency, he gave way. Ali also made sure to be on hand as Veron, Fezgau, and the men searched the caravan board by board. As she had expected, they had found nothing in the assassin's gear to indicate who had hired them. As professionals, they had stripped themselves of anything personal before they joined Gerhardt on Lomben. Returning to the castle after the search, Ali was joined by old Locage. He looked none the worse for his late evening. He was teasing her for her yawns as they wandered into the inner courtyard. There, one of the corporals put the off-duty armsmen through sword drills. Today, their numbers included Sarai, paired off with Fezgau, and the Duchess, who was learning the beginning drills under the corporal's instruction.
"Is she not beautiful?" asked Locage softly as he watched Sarai parry and disengage with cat-like grace.
"Like Gunapi."
"The sun rose, the goddess, I know," Ali interrupted, watching the girl and her partner. If she doesn't keep her guard up, she'll be skewered by someone who knows what he's doing. Locage looked up at Ali with a frown.
You know so much about it, I suppose.
Ali opened her mouth to say she knew plenty about swordplay, then closed it. Finally, she said,
I watched lots of armsmen practicing. I even saw the lioness fight.
Who?
Asked Locage. Ali stared at the little man. Who had not heard of her mother? The king's champion of Tortall, she informed him. The first female knight in over a century. The Lady Alana of Pirate Soup and Olau.
Locage shrugged.
A Luaran, he said dismissively. I only pay attention to them when it's a matter of survival or of protecting my lady's girls.
He rubbed a hand over his bristled chin thoughtfully.
So she's good, this lioness?
She's never lost a fight as king's champion.
Ali said, offended by Locage's disinterest. This was her mother, a lady acknowledged by all to be poetry with a sword in her hand. She looked at Sarai just as Fezgau sent the girl's sword flying into the air. Your Sunrose has a way to go to beat Alana the lioness. She walked on to the castle, feeling wistful. She'd never had to say more than her mother's name to describe her before. She was truly away from home to say lioness and not have every person within hearing turn to listen. This is a terrible time to find that I miss her, Ali thought, picking up her step. There's nothing I can do about it until autumn. To shake off her mood, Ali went to Chenaol and begged for chores. She was setting the dais table when Sarai walked into the great hall from outside, straggle-haired and sweat-soaked. She massaged her sword wrist wearily. Ali guessed that Sarai hadn't practiced as much as she'd meant to since her last official lesson. She was about to call out a suggestion that Sarai wrap her arm in hot, damp towels when Bronow emerged from the study near the staircase. He halted Sarai with a touch on the shoulder and murmured in her ear. Sarai looked up into his face, startled, then glanced around with the look of someone checking for her parents. Ali knew that look very well, having often used it herself. She held perfectly still. With the afternoon's light fading, the dais was in shadow, and so was she. Sarai nodded and whispered to the prince. Then she continued her climb up the stairs while Bronow retreated into the study and closed the door. It had been open before, Ali realized. The prince had been sitting in there waiting for Sarai to return. Once the table was set, Ali returned to the kitchen and took Chenaol aside. "Let Hasui pour," she murmured to the cook. "I have things to do." Chenaol nodded and beckoned to Hasui. Ali left to wash up. She ate in the shadows at the foot of the stair, her supper cheese and venison slices jammed into a cut roll. All seemed normal on the dais. Bronow, seated between Winamine and Sarai, plied the Duchess with his usual easy flow of conversation and compliments. He seemed to ignore Sarai next to him. Sarai, too, tried to pretend interest in Dove, seated next to her, and in her food, but she wasn't good at it. A blush mantled her cheeks. She had put a jeweled chain as a band around her forehead, with a citrine droplet dangling at its center. Citrines glinted from her earlobes. Her pale yellow silk dress had a neckline properly meant for court dinners, not country ones. A gold chain with a large gold-tinted pearl drew attention to the shadow between her breasts. Ali shook her head. If ever a girl was dressed for an assignation, it was Sarai. Ali could have taught her a thing or two about sneaking away to meet a man. Everyone in the room suspected, particularly her parents. She couldn't wait to see how the girl would get away from her family. Getting to her feet at the end of the meal, Sarai stumbled, bumping into Bronow. He fell sideways against Winamine as the Duchess raised her wine cup to her lips. Wine spilled down the front of Winamine's rose-colored gown. As servants, Bronow and Mequen scrambled to help the Duchess. Sarai quietly ducked out through the servants' door behind the dais. Ali had guessed that would be her way out. She entered the passage through another door under the shadow of the stair. On this level, the hall passed around the outer wall, allowing servants to bring dishes or messages to the dais without being seen by everyone in the room. The servants' stairs to the upper floors also ended here. The ground floor level had two exits, one directly into the kitchen, one to the outdoor area where Nawat had brought down the pair of would-be assassins. To the left of the outside door lay the ladies' garden, a small green oasis with a fountain, flowers, and trees tucked between the castle and keep walls, in a spot that drew sunlight every day. Its edges were planted with pines and ferns, which made it seem like part of a forest. The plants also gave Ali cover to hide in as Sarai arranged herself on the broad lip of the fountain. With the approach of night, the garden was deep in shadow. The only light came from torches on a walkway on the outer curtain wall. In these conditions, Ali got so close to Sarai that she could hear the girl's dress rustle as she fidgeted. Ali settled down to wait. The musical part of the evening's entertainment in the Great Hall had begun when Bronow came down the flagstone path. "Sarai, my dear." His voice was warm and intimate. Sarai's dress whispered as she got to her feet. "Your Highness, good evening." Bronow chuckled. He kissed Sarai's hand and sat on the lip of the fountain, pulling her down beside him. "That was very clever. I'm not sure Weena will thank you, but I don't believe anyone noticed that you left in all the excitement."
You said you had something important and private to discuss, Sarai pointed out shyly.
But I am distracted by the music of your voice, those lovely eyes, the sweet curve of your lips.
Ali couldn't see, but she didn't need to. Sarai's quiet gasp cut off abruptly, and the rustle of silk painted a clear picture of a kiss.
Oh, dear me, Ali thought, shaking her head.
Making up to your host's daughter, bad prince.
Now, why do you suppose he's doing it on the sly?
He's not married, and her parents are his friends. He could probably get permission from his grace to court Sarai.
My lord prince!
Sarai was definitely flustered.
It is so improper.
I know. I apologize. Bronau's voice was a little hoarse. My feelings carried me away. To watch you ride, to see you among your devoted subjects, like a true queen. None of Orin's wives were as graceful or as gracious as you. Don't look so alarmed. No one can hear us.
But you talk something like treason, your highness, Sarai warned gently.
I am no queen, only the daughter of a disgraced nobleman.
But if I asked you to be queen of my heart...
Ali crinkled her nose with distaste. She had sighed over speeches like that one in the stories she had read and the romantic ballads she had heard. In real life, they sounded tawdry. He was a prince of the realm, nearly 20 years older than Sarai. How could he talk like a minstrel performing for ladies in a bower? Did he think Sarai had no brains or honor?
Your Highness, why have you not asked my father's permission to address me in such terms? Sarai asked.
Her voice was small but firm.
He is your friend. So is my stepmother, for that matter. You used to court Weena.
Ah, Bronau's chuckle had an embarrassed sound.
To be honest, I hadn't meant to get so carried away, truly. But my feelings, the affection I had for Weena was that of practicality. She was a widow and my friend. I had found no true love, so I offered her a marriage of friendship. I thank the gods now that she preferred Mequin.
Don't fall for this dolt, Ali silently begged Sarai. I'll bet he wrote all these pretty speeches down and memorized them so he could make any maiden swoon all over him.
Unaware of his hidden critic, Bronau continued to talk. I escaped love for years, only to be plunged into it when I thought myself immune. I need to know from your own beautiful lips, would you be averse to a union with me? You would be queen of my heart in truth, and I would put the world at your feet.
Sarai's hesitation was marked. Ali raised an eyebrow, fascinated. Back in Tortal, she herself had sighed with the feelings of kisses and strong arms, yet she was still practical. The boys who had courted her had called her cold-blooded. Now it seemed that she and Sarai had that in common, that their hearts could be racing as their heads remained cool.
Your Highness, Sarai murmured at last, I cannot bring glory to your name. Tener and a few estates like it are my only inheritance. You have seen how poor it is.
I care nothing for your fortune, Sarai, Bronau said. There was enough passion in his quiet voice to almost convince Ali.
So I am an impractical fool. Certainly Rubinyan and that human Stormwing he married think so. But I would rather have a woman I loved than the plumpest heiress in the Isles. Unless...
His passion faded audibly with a trained actor's precision.
The difference in our ages...
Oh, no, Highness, that's not it at all. Sarai's emotion was not calculated. She spoke from the heart.
How could I... A man so alive as you...
There was the movement of cloth, the catch of breath, sighs and murmurs. Ali pushed back her cuticles, then carefully cleaned under her nails, waiting for conversation to start again. Bronau would do no more than kiss Sarai, not when there was a chance a sentry would look down from the parapet and see them. At last Bronau asked, his voice rough,
Will you marry me, Enchantress? Will you let me make you queen of the world?
Sarai was panting. Ali envied her. She liked kissing, too. At last Sarai managed to say,
Your Highness, I am not free to choose, if my father says I may. He is your friend. He won't refuse us if that's what we want. Bronow hesitated. At last he said, I cannot ask him. Not yet. I am under suspicion, as are you. Orin might see a union between us as a threat.
He sees everything as a threat,
Sarai reminded him. When I am in favor at court again, I will ask Mequen for your hand, if you wish to give it. Another stifled gasp. Ali wondered if they were going to do this all night.
I'll go back first, Bronow said. Give me time to reach my rooms before you return, and thank you for giving me hope.
Judging by the movement of shadows beyond her screen of ferns, Ali suspected Bronow kissed Sarai's hands, then her mouth, one last time before he left the garden. Now she also noticed that the ground under her was damp. The Duchess would skin her for getting another tunic dirty.
That wasn't very wise, a small, clear voice, Dove's, announced. And it was extremely improper, letting him get you alone. People would say you aren't very well brought up.
What do you know?
Sarai retorted, sounding like a cross 16-year-old, not a gently bred maiden swept away by her lover's kisses.
You're only 12, and you're not in the least romantic.
Good.
Firm steps sounded on the earth. A rustle of cloth announced that Dove was sitting by her sister.
Besides, Sarai added, I had a chaperone.
Didn't I, Ali?
Ali giggled and stood.
How did you know? She asked.
I just guessed, Sarai replied.
She and Dove were making sure her hair was tucked up and neatly pinned once more.
Why did you let them do that?
Dove wanted to know, bending around Sarai to glare at Ali.
It was so shameful.
Humph,
Sarai replied with a sniff. She tugged a lock of hair out of Dove's hold when she tossed her head.
Wait until you're my age and the blood's hot in your veins.
He's very handsome and charming.
And he's old,
Dove interrupted.
It was disgusting.
He's a man of the world,
Sarai informed her sister, her nose in the air.
So he's twice as likely to get you pregnant as a boy your own age who loves you and doesn't know what he's doing.
That's what Chenaul says,
Dove snapped.
Dova serite maidia balitang,
cried Sarai, shocked.
Never say Chenaul told that to you.
No, Dove said, her chin thrust out mulishly. She said it to one of the maids who's got one of Bronow's servants chasing her. But it means the same for you, doesn't it?
He never mentioned his debts, Ali pointed out, brushing a clump of moss from the front of her tunic. Sarai drooped and sighed.
No, he didn't. And he didn't talk to Papa first. But Ali, I think he's serious about the marriage.
Ali propped her chin on her hands.
I do too, she admitted. And it makes me uncomfortable. I hope it makes you uncomfortable. Or wary, at least.
Sarai laughed.
I don't need to be wary, she said, elbowing Ali. I have you and Dove for that.
Ali smiled evilly at Sarai, showing teeth. But not for explaining to their graces where you have been since supper. You may tell them Dove and I were present, of course, but we won't be there to sweeten the discussion for you.
Sarai looked from Ali to Dove, who gave her a grin identical to Ali's.
I'm going to read in the library for a while, she told Sarai. I'll come upstairs later.
Ali inhaled deeply.
I believe I'll enjoy the cool air for a bit, she said, her voice light. Summer nights are so lovely.
All right for you two,
Sarai told them sharply. She got to her feet.
I may as well get it over with, and I'll remember this.
She flounced down the flagstone path.
She always surprises me,
Dove remarked.
She didn't try to tell you that you're a slave, so you have to go with her.
No, she didn't, and she could have, Ali admitted. Most would have. Dove sighed.
That's Sarai for you. Just when you want to shake her until her teeth rattle, she does something like that.
She stood.
I really do mean to read for a while.
And I really do mean to sit, replied Ali.
She watched the younger girl leave, her soft leather shoes making no sound on the path. Sometimes talking to Dove was nearly as good as talking to Da or Aunt Dane. She remembered the time her mother had caught her kissing at a party for Prince Roald's engagement and grinned. The boy had fled, not wanting to deal with Ali's mother when she seemed so displeased.
Now look what you've done,
Ali had reproved Alana when the boy was out of earshot.
It'll take me weeks to train another one to kiss like I want him to.
Kisses are serious things, Alana had retorted. You talk of them as if they're party favors.
Ali had kissed her mother on the cheek.
They're serious for you, mother, she'd said.
They're party favors for me.
It was worth the scolding that followed about Ali's lack of seriousness to see the shock on the lioness's face and to see her mother realize that kisses didn't have to be serious. Of course, when Alana had been in her best kissing years, Ali remembered, most people had thought she was a boy. Boys were never as free with kisses among other boys. She sighed. They had the blood of Trebond in their veins, yet she and her mother were so different. She wondered if Alana had ever noticed that. She definitely needed Dad to remind her that life could be fun.
Was he mate-feeding her?
Ali looked up at the fringed tree across the bowl of the fountain.
Now what? She said, resigned more than surprised. Of course he would be here.
Nawat leaped to the ground and circled the fountain to sit next to Ali.
Is that mate-feeding? He asked.
It didn't look as if he'd transferred food to her tongue pouch, but it is hard to tell in the dark. I've seen other humans do it, only not this close to me. They do it in shadows as if it's a secret.
It's kissing, Ali explained, her mind half on how she had missed his presence in the tree and half on what she was saying.
Two people touch lips. It's mating behavior, but it's not mate-feeding, it's...
Nawat turned his head sideways and pressed his lips to Ali's.
His mouth was soft and warm, his breath lightly scented with spices, his smell clean, with hints of beeswax and wood oils from his work. Ali's usually distant and observing mind focused completely on the feeling of his mouth against hers. She dimly felt Nawat hesitate. Then he brushed his hand against the side of her neck and cradled the back of her head as he deepened the kiss.
Someone laughed in the distance. Ali jumped to her feet as if launched from a catapult.
"Yes, you've got the idea, but you should really practice on someone else," she told him, trembling from head to toe, furious with herself because, after all, she had been kissed before. "Somebody who isn't so busy or busy."
Nawat looked up at her, smiling slightly. For the first time, there was something in his gaze that was human and very male.
"You said busy twice," he pointed out.
"I'm very busy," Ali retorted. She stopped and caught her breath. What was the matter with her? She was no blossoming girl child with no experience or sense of proportion. She calmed down.
"But you can see, it's not mate-feeding.
Still, it's very serious, Nawat. You shouldn't go around kissing just anybody." Now she sounded like her mother.
Ali turned and strode down the path away from the crow man. She was doing her best to pretend that she was not running away. How could she care enough about this to run from someone who became a human male through sheer curiosity, who would eventually tire of it and return to his own shape? And why did she care if he wouldn't be around one day? The next morning, the merchant caravan left for Damari. Ali and Ulasim, along with 30 Raka and part Raka, surrounded the caravan when it reached the area where the road east cut through the rocks at the edge of Tener. Gerhardt and his people obeyed orders to step away from their mounts and wagons, plainly terrified of these masked and hooded riders. As soon as the travelers were seated under guard by the road's edge, Ulasim's people began to search the wagons and horses. Following Ali's instructions of that morning, they combed through the caravan, then its people. Ali, sweltering in her mask, followed Ulasim up and down the line of carts, horses, and people. She took care of the tricky bits herself as she taught Ulasim what she knew of caches and secret hiding places. Bronau's letters to his creditors were in Gerhardt's own mailbag, as were letters from the Balitongs, their servants, and their men-at-arms. Ali glanced over these in case she had missed anything, but they were straightforward enough. Soon they found the other letters, Bronau's to his brother's enemies, and all of the reports sent out by the royal spies and Rubinyan spies. Those were confiscated and burned. Ali would not risk word of anything unusual finding its way to Rajmuat. The merchants would tell what they had seen and could remember, but the worst piece of information they possessed was that Bronau sheltered with the Balitongs. Unless any spies in the caravan were very good and had been able to read the coded documents, they would have no other information that might alert a suspicious spymaster. When the searchers finished, they helped the merchants to reassemble the caravan, then saw them on their way.
No one would get the chance to sneak back and tell the castle spies that they had been robbed of information.
"You scare me sometimes, little one," Ulasim remarked as he watched the caravan's dust settle in its wake.
Ali yanked off the stifling hood that had covered her face and slave collar.